The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Times Square from 1980. If you do not wish to have this movie spoilt, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. Is it a punk celebration or a pile of junk? We watched Times Square from 1980 to see if we could redeem it. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad, I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project, this time checking out Times Square from 1980. I am the suggester of this movie and one of your hosts, Trevor Holland, and I am joined by my good friend and co-host,
Christian Fletcher, the viewer of this movie, or second critic of this movie. So thanks very much, Trevor, for having me back.
Or victim of this movie. Depending.
Yeah, there we go. Not giving anything away. We don't do spoilers. Only spoilers for the movie, not necessarily our thoughts.
That's right. Absolutely. We've got a long way to go before we work out if this movie is redeemable. So if this is your first listen, the purpose of the Rufus Project is to watch movies with less than stellar reputations and see if they are, in fact, redeemable. There you go. That's the entire Rufus Project in a very short sentence.
There you go. And a lot of times, too, Trevor, we're finding that we're probably watching movies that pique our own interests, even if it's not necessarily a movie that we would have thought of. And I believe you stumbled on this movie, a title which I had actually forgotten about after, you know, sort of knowing or seeing a little bit of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I just stumbled across the soundtrack album of it not that long ago. And I'll say straight up, I mean, there is certainly nothing wrong with the soundtrack of this movie. Oh my God, it's good.
Oh, definitely. Anyway. And I had to keep Wikipedia-ing, if that's that's a term now, as yeah, I was watching the movie, just to double check that soundtrack and go, oh, I heard that song. I think there was only one song that was left off, I believe, the double LP. And when something's a double LP, you know it's possibly going to be pretty good, or it's very much a soundtrack-based movie.
Yeah, well, I may have a little bit of a bit of trivia about that. Anyway.
I didn't want to go too far early.
That's all good. Now, before we get too much further into trivia and discussing the movie, we do need to look at a few other bits and pieces. So if you haven't seen Times Square, I keep wanting to just roll those together. I'm trying not to. I have a synopsis here. Two ill-matched teenage girls form a punk band and soon have New York City by its ears.
Oh my God, even just hearing that plot summary, it just seems to be, I don't know, one of the cliches or one of the go-to plot synopsis of the punk film, essentially, which I suppose is the genre this fits into, or the new wave film.
We shall talk about, shall we say, where this movie may not fit as we go, or if indeed if it manages to fit anywhere.
No, I don't think it even knows, but yeah, we'll let it go.
But before we get there, now, this one does have a couple of mentions on the old awards page on IMDb. It received two nominees at the Stinkers Bad Movie Awards. One was Worst Actress for Robin Johnson, and the other one was Most Annoying Fake Accent Female, also for Robin Johnson.
Oh, God, she didn't go too well with that. But and I believe they were trying to sort of, this being a Robert Stigwood production, which I'm sorry, Trevor, if I step on any of the trivia toes, but
all good.
I do believe they were trying to bill Robin Johnson or build her as the female John Travolta, which is funny because I think they said that the same with Olivia Newton-John with Grease. So, for her to get a rap like that, maybe it didn't quite go the way they planned.
Perhaps not. But we'll get into a bit of the turkey trivia. This is where we talk turkey about the movie and then talk trivia. I explain that every time. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. Anyway, so this movie is rated 6.7 out of 10 on IMDb. It had a budget of $5 million and a box office of $1.4 million.
I was even surprised that it had a $5 million budget, considering its sort of documentary style and sort of low budget, aesthetic. very much a punk aesthetic, so I suppose criticism, I shouldn't really criticize too much. But a dud on all accounts.
Absolutely. So what we've got here is a bit of trivia now. The film was inspired by a diary that the director Alan Moyle found in a second-hand couch that he bought, and the diary was from a young mentally disturbed woman that featured words and drawings about her life on the streets.
That would explain a lot of the, I suppose, poetry angle of the film, which was probably, something that came up quite a bit.
Yes. Definitely, we'll get to that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm always jumping ahead, aren't I? I think it's too much to say about this movie.
I was about to start talking about things in the movie, but that's fine. Now, Alan Moyle had a bit of fun, though, because at one point he was going to be sacked because the production company wanted him to change the film so they could put in more music to ensure they had a double album soundtrack.
Ah, I did hear something about that. And also to a lot of the, we'll get to this, I'm sure, the cutout scenes or the director's cut of the film, but there are also a lot of inappropriate songs that I believe Robert Stigwood said, nah, I don't want it on the soundtrack because I want this to be essentially the next Saturday Night Fever, which at that stage was the biggest selling soundtrack of all time.
I mean, you're saying that, I suppose the movie itself and how they wanted to be perceived. I mean, several scenes apparently suggested a possible lesbian attraction between Nikki and Pamela, the two main female characters, and they were ultimately cut from the final version of the film.
And did I read somewhere, too, they've lost, like, it'll never be restored because they've actually lost the print or lost those extra scenes. So what we've got is pretty much it. But that would probably explain, don't want to go too far ahead, but would explain some of the situations later on where you're kind of going, hang on, it seems like something's missing, hence these scenes. So, in that sort of circumstance and the fact that there's, scenes in a strip club and stuff like that, I believe this is very much going for more of an adult or a late teen audience.
Yeah, well, it certainly drops F-bombs with regular regularity. I think, it was R-rated when it came out in the US, so which is like MA-15 plus over here.
Yeah.
It was going for a more mature audience.
And I'm also... Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to move on to one of the other things that caught my eye when I was looking at the soundtrack was the fact that top billing goes to the great Tim Curry, who we all love as Dr. Frankenfurter from Rocky Horror. But he only really played a supporting role and got top billing as he was the only cast member who was largely known to the film audiences of the time. And he filmed all his scenes in just over 2 days.
Oh, yeah, I can't believe that. And having read that trivia going into the movie, you're thinking, you are very much ripped off by saying he's the star. But, us being big Rocky Horror fans, and I'm sure a lot of our audience, you can very much tell that this was released at the peak of Rocky Horror fandom. And it was, made in the late 79 and released in 80. So it was very much, I believe, made for the Rocky Horror audience, because Tim Curry, whilst never a major player in films, he did have a late 70s music career. I don't know how successful it was, but I get the feeling. I've got a couple of his albums. I'm hoping one day they'll be collector's items, but we'll wait and see. But I do get the feeling it was very much, I don't know if it's me just being biased, but was very much playing to that inbuilt Rocky Horror audience, the same that, say, a movie like possibly Shock Treatment was as well, or definitely that New York midnight movie scene, I think, and that's obviously what we see typified in the movie.
Yes, indeed. Now, my remaining trivia does go back to that very awesome soundtrack. It's not all awesome. There are a few hits and misses on there, and I will discuss some of those, I guess, as we go. But apparently producer Robert Stigwood insisted on including a Bee Gees song on the soundtrack, basically because he produce Saturday Night Fever.
I remember noticing Robin Gibb, I think, in one of the credits at the end. So, yeah, that would have been a couple of the songs. But, yeah, he just couldn't get away thinking the Bee Gees were invincible.
Yeah. Doesn't really fit with the rest of it, but we'll get back to that. And for a long time, the soundtrack album of this film was the only available recording for the Ramones' I Wanna Be Sedated.
Aha, because I do know it did have a re-release in the late 80s, so yeah, that would have helped a lot. And God, the amount of movies that have used that film in the same kind of way, but we'll get to that as well.
Indeed, we will. Now, that's probably it for the trivia. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we do aim to see if we can redeem movies on this podcast, which means we need to set our baseline. So I checked out Amazon and I grabbed a review. It's a bit of a longer one this time, but I think it nicely sums up what we're working from. The title of this review is Straight from the Imagination of Some Sleazy Old Movie Exec. Robert Stigwood, the guy that produced Grease, the Bee Gees, Sgt. Pepper deal, and other atrocities, takes on punk new wave. Don't believe punk is dead? See this movie and weep. Two unbelievable social constructs become fast friends and escape from a local mental hospital. Why? The script says so. One is a depressed, misunderstood rich girl, the other a butch nutjob. The rich girl gets a job in a strip joint, but won't go topless and insists on wearing dresses. She gets a job because the owner says she's classy. The mental girl is really poetic. You know, one of them artistic types. They live in a stunning squat, which apparently furnishes itself moments after they arrive. Tim Curry ain't no great actor, as evidenced in this film, but he must have lost a bet to appear in this. What's his motivation in this film? Why does he care so damn much about these kids? Why is he so damn light in the loafers? Why all the convoluted movements? It was an unintentional laugh riot when it first came out. Now it's just boring and dated. At its core, Times Square is every bit as conservative as any mainstream teen film of the 50s. One star.
I did have a chuckle at a few of those, but yeah, you find yourself nodding, but you also go, hang on. But yeah, it can only go up or sideways or backwards from here.
Absolutely. Well, at least it was under 2 hours, but I think that may have come into some of those scenes we mentioned earlier that were cut out.
Oh, yeah, that was one of those moments where I was thankful those scenes were missing, even if it did mean me scratching my head later on with a few moments. But yeah, getting under the being an hour 50 was perfect.
And I mean, it started with the Roxy music, some nice early 80s, late 70s, 80s Roxy music, but those titles were so 70s. Oh, I mean, they were basically out of Saturday Night Fever.
Well, it's so funny because I think it was, I hate to remind you, but thank God it's Friday. I think they used the whole neon title very much, and I'm like, I must admit this was done a lot more appealing, and possibly the film was a bit more appealing than that one. So I did appreciate that. And the fact you didn't waste any time getting straight into it. Look, I went to Times Square back in May, so it is interesting being able to see this document of I actually looked this up. It was filmed in October 1979, so it's good to see Times Square sort of in that period, and they don't waste any time getting into it.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly have fun doing the seedy city shots as they pan around behind the 70s titles and the and the early 80s music. Well, I should say late 70s music, and yeah, it's like, okay. And then we get to meet our main character, played by our good Stinkers Awards nominee, Robin Johnson, who's playing Nicky. And I think the first question is, why are you playing guitar in a dark alley in the back of Times Square? It doesn't seem like the best idea.
Yeah, exactly. Like, especially when we're hit straight away. Okay, we obviously know she's a runaway, or we get that sort of vibe, but I'm sort of hit straight away by, are we watching Joan Jett? It seemed like, oh, so many parts of this movie I thought we were. But, like, I know you mentioned it was weird, her singing, playing the guitar in the alley, and then somewhat shocked when people came out and complained. And then this random girl who's saying, oh, the boss is upstairs and that's his car. Like we know anything about who this boss is or really care at this point. But I did appreciate the parts where she started to strum the guitar and it kind of linked in with the music on the soundtrack. Like that was cool. That could have been a bit more improv with it, but I like how they kind of synced it in. Look, this is me going in possibly with high hopes and thinking this was the start of something when I see a lot of things like this in movies.
Yeah, it was kind of like a bit of give and take there, because sometimes it did go in and other times they just had this discordant, you know, someone just strumming an electric guitar and just making it loud because I think it sounds good. So it was very interesting. It was kind of an interesting dynamic there where it sometimes seemed to go in with the music, again, Roxy music, and other times it was just like a ka-ching across the top. You go, oh, is she meant to be a good player or not? Again, I can't tell.
And I think the girl even comes out and goes, "Your playing's terrible anyway," or something like that. So, and then she proceeds to smash the car. So we soon realise that, okay, she's the bad girl. And I think going in knowing that there's two girls in this plot, I wonder what the other side's going to be. And it always seems to be this exact juxtaposition, and it seemed to be like this straight away. We're taken straight away to a, I say courtroom, but a room of politics. I don't know. I think we've worked out. He said something about being a public servant, but I believe he's a politician. And I'm just, you know, he gets up and talks about how his daughter was, how he's liberal and okay with his daughter sneaking into an R-rated movie, but I just didn't like her seeing it in 42nd Street. And, so we're kind of given that juxtaposition straight away of this, the runaway, which, what's her name? Nikki, that's right. And then Pamela, this stifled one. And honestly, the plot's been done before. You can see it a mile away, what's going to happen. And I just was like, hurry up and get to it.
because they set up Pamela's dad as, you know, he was getting up there talking about how he's going to clean up Times Square, and he's telling a story about his daughter wanting to go, and she's just, we get the shot of her just going, "It's a lie, it's a lie, it's a lie," and then she runs off and hides in the bathroom, which apparently is enough to take her to a mental institution because she didn't like her dad lying about her for political purposes. Funny that. But, you know, there's a very strong, like, start. You think the whole, this conservative politician wanting to, you know, you expect that cliche of this conservative wanting to take away, you know, what makes Times Square and gentrification and stuff like that, which never goes anywhere. It's basically just an excuse to say, Pammy is upset with her dad, and that's apparently enough to get her mentally assessed.
And look, you've hit the nail on the head. That's probably the first time in the movie, because it happens many times where they'll bring up something and it just doesn't go anywhere, where it could have actually been quite a meaty, not subplot, possibly main plot of the film, where it's these girls rebelling whilst the father is trying to restore Times Square. But unfortunately, like you said, it doesn't go anywhere and is thrown out, possibly on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose she doesn't go straight to the mental asylum. We get to hear Tim Curry,
that recognizable voice that comes in straight away.
read the letter from her saying that she's a zombie girl, and I mean him as Johnny LaGuardia. I mean, I'm not too sure what he was reaching for, but at times I'm thinking, what you're saying makes absolutely no sense, and the way you're saying it is just absolutely comical. Is like, I don't know what he was going for. The city has all these things happening.
And he seemed to make a big thing about him being some sort of godly figure at the top of Times Square, looking down on the sweltering heat. Come down and visit us sometime. But it's like, because they'd brought in, I don't know if they'd brought it in at this stage, probably I think in the hospital, the fact that Pamela likes poetry, but it's almost like the scriptwriter's gone, oh, why don't we eventually have them drawn to each other by having Tim Curry speak in nothing but prose? It seems like that for the first quote. And I think even, I can't remember offhand what he said. Actually, sorry, it's the letter from the zombie girl. And his speech is quite intense, almost like, I don't know if it felt like, as you said, you don't know what he's going for, but almost like he was just trying to spit out every word and just get the hell out of that studio.
Yeah, but then he goes and talks to her and saying, you know, sometimes you just got to jump into the darkness. You're telling a depressed teenager in New York City to jump into the darkness. I don't know if that's the best advice, really. I mean, yeah. Sorry, that really made me kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah,
to be honest, when that happened, almost as uncomfortable as later when we get a shot of Tim Curry basically lying back, listening to tapes of himself.
Oh, I know. There were so many scenes where you're thinking, because he kept coming on about, oh, things have to be live. And there'd be so many shots of him actually, listening to pre-recorded bits or past shows. So, I don't know. It was quite strange. It was almost like an attempt to try and flesh his part out. But, again, it doesn't sort of really go anywhere. And as we find later on, I think a lot of his scenes or possible other stuff had been cut out as well. But you mentioned I Want to Be Sedated earlier on. Just little obvious things like, okay, this is what I have to talk about, the soundtrack. You know, obviously being a double LP, you expect the soundtrack to have quite a big part in the movie. But as we find straight away, sort of only playing segments of it before we even we get a taste of it before they even give us a little bit more.
I mean, I'm sucker for music which I suppose complements what's going on, you know, when they use the music cinematically.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, like, I mean, with how I Want to Be Sedated, I mean, it was kind of groovy that, you know, Nikki had her ghetto blaster with her in the mental asylum, and she just kept playing I Want to Be Sedated, and so you got her not only just doing that as obviously to be a pain in the ass, because she's deliberately being a pain in the ass, but then, you know, you also do get some of the actual action when they're running around later during the escape, which is used, well, they use that song quite effectively. And that's like, it's like, you know, other times, like, a song will kick in and it's just basically the song that Tim decided to play at the radio after his latest rant.
But I think
it's just like, oh yeah.
Yeah, but the thing I noticed, even, you know, sort of jumping ahead a little bit, by the second half of the movie, they were starting to sort that sort of stuff out. They were sort of feeling a bit more like, I don't know, I mean, it's easy for me to go the angle of calling them musical numbers, but there were so many wasted opportunities where they could have extended into some kind of, not even a dance sequence, not a musical sequence, but, you know, something a little bit more substantial. But definitely in the first half of the movie, we were sort of only given, as you said, like little glimpses or little tastes, especially when, you know, the stuff that Tim was playing. But I did like how they worked things out in the second half, but like little daggy things like her playing I Want to Be Sedated and the doctor comes in later. Shouldn't that patient be sedated? Like little obvious things like that, I went, ooh. You know, but they thankfully didn't do it too often.
Yeah, but when they're all going into the hospital, it's like, well, look, Pam, the daughter of this influential politician, would never be put in the same room as a girl that was arrested in an alley.
Ah, that was so strange straight away, almost like they were just asking for that plot to develop. Like, how else are we going to have these girls have anything to do with each other? Yeah, it was quite strange. And even any time the father would go, does that girl need to be in here, they'd find out some excuse and it'd just be sort of brushed to the side.
Oh, they were undergoing the same tests or something. I think that was the entire justification of having them in the same room.
Oh, okay. Or justification of why they can become friends and have a plot for the movie, I suppose.
Yeah. To be this odd couple of completely different girls who... And I mean, it's really Nikki that drives the action. Pam just kind of passively goes along with it.
But you must admit, it doesn't take her long to kind of warm to Nikki. Like, that's the thing. Like, she's very bashful and obviously, you know, thinks that she's a bit full on from the start. But it doesn't take her very long to start, I suppose, rebelling. But I suppose that a lot of that would have been built in with sort of anger against her father. But I think I even had in my notes that Nikki ends up being a bad influence, but not really a bad influence. She more just helps her, I suppose, break out of her shell, even if it means doing, you know, semi-illegal things.
Oh, straight out illegal things. Like,
yeah, definitely.
Shoplifting and you know, involved in mugging people.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And with some really bad wigs. I'm like, if you're going to go undercover, girls, maybe don't choose a bright pink afro. And then I think it's funny, they go to this wig shop and get all these disguises, and I think they ended up throwing them in the next scene, and then you're like, aren't you still on the run? Shouldn't you be staying undercover? There's a lot of weird decisions, but it seemed like a lot of stuff was turned a blind eye. But hang on, it was all possibly building for their cult status that we would find out later on in the movie.
Yeah, quite possibly. And even with as they were escaping, and the ambulance they escaped in would have had police cars all over it within like two blocks, let's be honest. But again, this movie seems to conveniently decide when anything sensible is going to happen, which isn't very often, let's face it. But as they escape and you have a shot of the dad talking with someone about, we don't want the press to be involved. And then it comes back to the radio station, and the radio station had worked out that Zombie Girl was Pam, the daughter of the politician, somehow. It's just like, oh, that's Zombie Girl, okay. And then they had like a copy of the medical reports or something.
Oh, yeah.
Just very conveniently handed to them, which leads to Tim Curry basically encouraging them to run again. It's like, but he's like the early morning DJ as well. So how is, like, dad's in the office, but yet he can still listen to Tim Curry, who does like the 4 a.m. radio shift.
And you get the feeling from this show, and just probably from the characters that come in, that it possibly doesn't have a big listenership. So I find it unusual that this girl's kind of reaching out to. It's kind of coming across a bit creepy. It's almost like she's his only listener. But as we find out later on, he seems to have a bit more of influence. Or actually, later on when they do that concert, it seems like it's not him, but all the other radio stations that get all the people there. So I'm a bit confused about what his pull is. I have a feeling he thinks he's a bit better than what he is, and she's just this lone girl who's sort of reached out to him. But yeah, it does come across a bit creepy. And when we find out sort of stuff in the second half, when they end up sort of trying to instigate, well, this relationship that sort of comes out of nowhere, it's, sort of enhances that creepiness.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't want to jump to that bit.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. Yet,
but, no, that's okay, because, I mean, again, like, you know, there's no point in just trying to recount the movie. Mm-hmm. Because it's hard to talk about this movie because, yeah, obviously it's so obvious that there were so many cuts in this movie because once they get out of the mental asylum, it kind of goes at a steady pace to that point. And then it's just cut to a scene, cut to a scene, cut to a scene with very little like link in them in the middle. This is very, very sudden changes and very, very sudden clashes. They suddenly turn up in an abandoned ruined building, which has some very majestic music going for this abandoned building, and then suddenly Pam saying that Nikki's a poet the way she talks, and then they have a low key chase scene, and suddenly we're back to the radio studio, and Tim Curry's reading a letter from Pam to her dad. Again, this is, you know, he's in the early morning shift, so I don't know how Pam assumed that her dad would be listening to this guy at this time in the morning. It just, you know, it's not like they had the internet back then.
And the thing is, too, another one of those options, or I think they call it a non sequitur, or I can't pronounce it, but another plot that doesn't go anywhere. That could be another thing where it could have been this quite cool part of the film or the plot where, you know, she was pretty much revealing her whereabouts and her details via these letters. But unfortunately, we're not given a build-up. It's just a letter, and then she's seen somewhere, and then the girls are somewhere else. It almost felt like, probably from this period on, that they were trying to give us, I don't know, a postcard shot of what New York looked like in 1979. Like, trying to, as somebody who's been there recently, it did feel like they would be doing the tourist thing and going to every possible, I suppose, cliche that they could. Not saying that I went to porn theaters, but you know, they were trying to do all of that kind of stuff. I actually wasn't surprised, Trevor, that if they didn't end up at a Rocky Horror Picture Show screening, you know, in that section where they were doing the magic tricks and all that. It just seemed like the whole thing was becoming this travelogue for New York City, you know, whilst the girls were exploring, with no sort of rhyme or reason to them doing so, except the fact that was supposed to be shown that Nikki is leading, I suppose, Pam to the, well, not down the wrong track, but giving her freedom. But there's just so many things that they could have done more with. Again, Tim Curry, it could have been linked in more, but he was just, I don't know, trying to be the voice of God, and it just didn't work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do want to know, because you mentioned you went to Times Square and yeah, kind of relating to them in some way. Did you go dancing down the street to the sounds of Talking Heads? Because I approved of that scene.
I'm wishing I'd seen the movie first, because I would have. Look, based on my experience, there wouldn't be room to dance down it. It was actually refreshing to see what it looked like in that period, because it was. I actually really liked the seediness of it. It's a lot more touristy now. But Trevor, a wasted opportunity, but I will do it next time I'm there.
Yeah, very, very good.
But I loved that.
And then at the end of it, where they suddenly come across the bus, and it's got like the giant sign on the side of the bus, which was basically a photo of Pam, you know, was it milk cartons over there that they have the missing people
yeah,
on?
Yeah, just big billboards Pam, everywhere.
Pam got the side of a bus which somebody had, like,
tagged,
written, like, a bit of tagged saying, yeah, you know, yep. Oh, she's one of the Sleaze sisters or something, and they decided to colour in, a rubber mask over her eyes, and suddenly, hey, we can be the Sleaze Sisters, and you got a poem. Okay, we'll go back to this topless bar where Pam refuses to go topless, that we mentioned earlier, and suddenly the poem is a full-on song, and really given the enthusiasm and the status of the crowd in that bar that we had seen up to this point, there is no way they would be into the song that that Nikki is singing. And she just keeps singing it too. Like, it finishes and then she launches into the last chorus again. And it finishes and she launches into the last chorus again. I'm going, you can stop now. Okay, we got the point.
I didn't mind the set design of that that Cleopatra's Club. It was very 60s kitsch. Just a little side note there. But yeah, I do know what you mean. I think they even, I don't know if it was that same scene earlier on before they sang, or it might have been actually the scene where Pamela first starts dancing. But it's like they purposely show the girl in the corner putting the record on, almost like with this very drab audience. But it's almost like, yeah, but of course when the Sleaze Sisters start performing, the whole place comes to life. But again, we're not given a lead up to that. Why are they suddenly performing there? And it's like the whole time that Pam is performing at that club, Nikki sort of plays her pimp just sitting there watching. And I think even Pam goes, you'd be better suited doing something in this club than I would. And even I was sitting there going, yeah, what's Nikki's role in this? And the next thing she's performing. Again, Trevor, I feel like we're missing all these scenes, all these lead ups to how we got to this point.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, they just happen. That's the thing. They just happen.
What could it could have been an awesome movie. Again, another subplot of them trying to get a band together. That was their way of rebelling. Punk music, the whole point of these films. But again, another wasted opportunity. But I'm sorry to interrupt, but a couple of times earlier, and you know this has been done in other movies too. I'm just thinking of was it Dangerous Minds with Michelle Pfeiffer, where she teaches all the kids at an urban high school through music that it's actually poetry, and there's a few times that was brought up, and that's sort of how Nikki related to music was to poetry was through the music, and I thought another wasted opportunity to do something with it. You know, that's where the poetry thing could have gone, but no, it didn't quite work out that way. And yeah, so again, I'm wondering what was cut off this film, or whether it actually was ever intended half this stuff to go anywhere.
I'm just thinking, if they had all the linking scenes in to make all the sudden jumps make more sense, this would have been a very long movie.
I know. But the fact that we finally get to, I've even written that here, we finally get to them a musical performance. Not saying that this is a musical, but it could have really lent itself to that kind of stuff in the lead up. But an hour in and we've got Damn Dog Now, which I think is the song, which she ends up repeating again for some reason, considering the other heaps of awesome songs you could have picked to sing as a second song. But anyway, I was really quite surprised it was actually Robin Johnson singing, which I gave her praise for. But yeah, an hour in and we're finally getting a musical performance. I thought a little too late, maybe.
Yeah, it took a very long time with a lot of just stuff happening before we get to the point, which, but like I said, for the synopsis is that these girls form a punk band, but they don't really. I mean, Pam isn't really part of the band. Like, the rest of the band just kind of turns up just conveniently for this performance of Damn Dog in the Cleopatra Club. And you think, where were they before? Where'd they come from? They know the song well. They rehearsed. I don't know what's going on. Oh, look, someone's told the dad where his daughter is, and now he's in the club, and they see each other, and Pam run out, and oh, look, it's the next day.
Yeah, and I think, but the funny thing is, the next day, actually, it might be earlier than this, but the next day when I think they say, we spotted Nikki hanging outside. She's pretty much essentially hustling outside a venue or trying to sell stuff. And he takes her down to a side alley and, you know, essentially slaps her a few times, which I thought was quite weird. Like, okay, I know how he's feeling towards her, but he just was sort of grabbing her arms, not letting her go. But it's just funny how he gets a tip. Oh, yeah, Nikki's out across the road. It's just like, I don't know. Again, maybe they should be keeping those wigs on. I know they weren't very good, but maybe as disguise would be good. Because I think by now we're getting so much media attention, but they don't seem to care. They're sort of relishing in it as sort of these rock star icons. Again, a plot that we sort of, or possibly an ambition that we're not given any knowledge about before this.
Yeah, and really, they do. Like, really ramp up, you know, that you should not like the dad. I mean, because, yeah, he slaps Nikki. There's another scene where he confronts Tim Curry in the radio station and basically throws him against the wall and threatens to kill him in front of witnesses.
Yeah.
And Tim's just basically smug at him because... Tim Curry, I mean,
yeah.
Not really much other thing there. and then suddenly news of the Slee Sisters is all over the place because they've decided their guests going to drop TVs off the top of buildings.
Yeah.
For no real good purpose aside from Nikki wanted it to be their gimmick.
Oh, it was so strange. It was almost like Robert Stigwood sat down. Look, I don't know anything about Robert Stigwood in terms of as a person. He might not have been very much up to date with the punk movement. So it's almost like he's thought of every cliche, you know, rock stars throwing TVs out of hotel rooms. That's where it possibly, it's sort of, what's something that can represent the punk rebellion? But it didn't just happen once. I was actually waiting, Trevor, for it to hit someone in the head and the movie was going to go off on this whole other tangent. But thankfully it didn't happen. But it did seem quite a strange thing. Like, what's anything punk we can think of, any cliche that sort of typifies destruction and rebellion? Let's put it in this movie.
Yeah, and it's dropping... you know, I don't find dropping TVs pretty punk. I mean, most punk bands would probably just go, oh, those are those bloody hard rockers. We don't want to be like them. We're
good point. More hard rock, I suppose. But I'm thinking about a very naive producer, filmmaker going in. It could be something that he sees as, I don't know. But I also think Video Killed the Radio Star, big 1979, big 1980. It was the time when that sort of stuff was happening. Maybe it was kill your TV and I don't know. It was quite strange.
It was. And the second that Pam said, oh, we better stop before we hurt someone. I mean, really, you've been doing this. I don't know how long they were doing it for either, because there's no sense of how long they were doing it for, but there was just this shot and shot after shot. And then there's, you know, Tim Curry doing update after update after update, which you assume would be on different nights, of them just dropping the TV. And when Pam finally says, no, I think we need to stop that before we hurt someone, then Nikki just completely loses it. sets up Tim Curry to come around with hints of an exclusive and then runs away. And then comes back and acts like it would have made sense if they actually had left anything suggesting a romantic relationship between Pam and Nikki. But she comes in like a jealous lover and just starts absolutely trashing the place and going, you know, absolutely over the top. And to me, it just felt like, oh, we've kind of been goofing along and just doing stuff. We need to add some tension and drama. I know, we'll just have Nikki deliberately set up something where she can throw a big tantrum.
And from the angle we've seen with the cut that we see, which obviously sounds like the only cut in existence nowadays, is the fact that it seems like Tim Curry just seems to come on the scene for 2 seconds and Nikki's rage just sort of builds up. However, we're not given any sort of, maybe a few hints earlier, few scenes prior to this, but we're not really given that big build-up to this overall. And, yeah, it just screamed something has been cut out of this movie. I did appreciate, not appreciate, but I did like how she destroyed the warehouse and then donned that kind of Batman makeup. It reminded me a lot of Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns, you know, that real transformation into a superhero character. But it was, again, too little too late. I think we're at an hour 20 by this stage, and you just sort of, you know, again, you feel like you've been ripped off the build-up or, you know, sort of any connection. You didn't even feel any sort of love interest earlier with Tim Curry and Pamela. So the whole point of having that was just sort of irrelevant.
Yeah, and at the end of it, Pam basically calls Tim Curry a creep anyway. So you're going, what was the point of all of that? I don't get it.
Oh, but then, going to say, like, you know, and then the big gum. Oh, but because Tim Curry's sort of off the scene because they have a big fight, you know, he doesn't help promote their. They decide to have a. Find my notes about this. Sorry, they final. I think they decide to have their final. Again, another cliche for the punk movie or the rock movie, the final concert on the rooftop, you know, they're going to have that. And I think Tim's off the scene. But it's funny, without Tim, they get more promotion than they did when he was on the scene. It's funny. But then without any sort of apology, like he's pretty annoyed with these girls. He still keeps creeping on. And I think he eventually starts doing even more promo for the concert as well. So and it's a character that sort of then doesn't really get his, I don't know, the plot's never really solved or, you know, that love thing. It just sort of goes after she kicks him out
pretty much. And he ends up being perched on top of the building because he's got his bird's eye view of Times Square. And we get these shots of all these young teen girls who have never seen, I mean, there was like one live performance of a song full of words that we can't really say in this
yes,
podcast.
That's right.
Again, on Tim Curry's graveyard shift, you know, sparrow's fart time of the morning. And yet suddenly all these young teenage girls are flocking to Times Square, leaving dressed exactly like Nikki in like the garbage bag thing with the same makeup on their face. They have never seen either of these girls and would have no idea that that was their look.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just, and the parents just going, oh, where you're going? Oh, we're going to the concert. Okay, then, have fun. And all these teenage girls are just ascending on Times Square.
I know.
We're dressed in this particular way, and you got people very quickly on street corners selling them like bottles of water. And what was it? A guy with garbage bags. Going,
oh, yeah, that's right.
What is going on?
I don't know if they should be more worried about the fact they're going to the concert or the fact that they're tuning into radio at 4:30 in the morning every morning to hear these reports. But as I did say, I can't remember how widespread it was, but there was those parts where it showed that they were getting a lot of coverage for it. But again, if people, the sort of girls that it was appealing to, they're not going to hear it punk and go, yeah, this is something I want to be into. But I must admit, for a movie that all the plots never really sort of go anywhere, I did appreciate they brought back the TV thing and had the girls leaving for the concert and they've smashed their TV outside. Again, too little too late.
Yeah. And again, it's like, I mean, yeah, fine. They would have heard about that bit, but again, they had no idea that was Nikki's look. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. It's funny. I do, like, it was sort of around this point, and it's probably a bit silly for not noticing it earlier, but, you know, I started to realise the fashion a lot more. When I say fashion, the fact that, you know, they've been quite clever with the way they designed this film and you know, had very much the clothes. Not even thrift shop, it's trash clothing. And I don't mean that in an affectionate way. So it was kind of around this point that I started to realise, oh, yeah, the outfits that Nikki's been wearing have been pretty way out and clever. Thrifty.
yeah, absolutely. But yeah, you know, well, I mean, we get to the point where they don't turn up and they have a whole tension thing about Nikki not wanting to perform because she'll just, well, I'll say screw it up. That's not exactly what she says. And of course, we have that thing where she's up there on top of the, I think they're on top of like a cinema marquee or something like that.
Yeah, I looked it up because, yeah, it didn't seem familiar to me. I actually think, Trevor, it's a Macca's now from memory, but it's all Broadway billboards and stuff now. So it's changed quite a lot. But yeah, it looked like the top of a cinema, I think, was pronounced. It looked to me like it kept saying Dark Knight Rises, but something Dark Rises. But anyway, I believe a cinema.
Yeah, it probably was meant to be a porno.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I don't know. They never really showed you too much of that.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, she gets to do half a song, which is Bam Dog again, before the police turn up and shut her down. And then she jumps off into a waiting mattress down the bottom.
Oh, was it a mattress? I was thinking...
amongst the fans or...
I was thinking they'd been clever and tied all the garbage bags together and made a little, like, parachute. I was giving them more credit than I should have, I think.
Maybe, but again, the little teenage girl fans down there, they were ready for her to jump off.
Yeah, they were doing it heaps before. Thing.
You know, again, not something they would have known was coming, but, you know, they make sure they catch her nicely, and she runs off, leaving Pam to be an accessory to whatever, well, I'm just sure, a whole range of laws they were breaking.
Oh, yeah.
And then suddenly her dad is up on top of the cinema with her, and they kind of look at you as if everything's okay.
And then it just pans out, and we're getting the sort of a similar shot to the opening shot, where it's a shot down Times Square. And Trevor, even here, I'm thinking maybe they cut the ending off.
but that's when the Bee Gees kicks in.
Oh, yeah, that's
right.
Lonely
Girl song, and I'm just going, this song is just. This song clashes with everything else in this movie.
Exactly. But the part that
going on?
Like, oh, that was so jarring to me. But even before that song came in, I thought it was so funny. As soon as she, Nikki can't even get, one verse into Damn Dog, which is thankful. Nothing against the song, but I would have liked to have heard her perform a different song. But anyway, yeah, it was cut short quickly. But what I love is, the cops are trying to shut her down. But as soon as she parachutes off or mattresses off the building, that you see the band in the background still continue, and everyone's all cool because they're all hugging, as you said, with Pam and the dad on the roof. And it's like, okay, because Nikki's not there now, just keep performing. And very jarring song. And I've even got in my notes here, why wasn't the last song a punk song, or at least some kind of new wave song? And I'm assuming, I don't know if the LP's in chronological order, but is the Robin Gibb song the last song on the album?
No, I don't think it is, actually. I think the last song we get is on the album is Damn Dog, actually. Oh, but
okay.
Like a reprise. We get this very jarring song before it fades to black, and we get back to the same Roxy Music song from the start, which I found was actually a bit of a relief.
Oh, I know. It was good hearing it again, but it's also like, you know how sometimes when you're going into a movie, like with those opening, we said the nice neon lights, Times Square, this is going to be awesome. You're kind of reminded of what the movie probably could have been in that hour and 50 by hearing that song again. But, and that weird, I know before that, we've even got over the Robin Gibb song, but the weird collage, and just kind of like, this is,
Oh, God.
Kind of remind me of Greece, you know, when they've all got the graduation hats, those kind of photos, and like, just like newspaper clippings or something. Quite strange. Again, even with the, I know we don't get stingers in 1980, but I was still even watching the credits going, okay, we're going to find out what happened to Tim Curry, or where did Nikki end up? But alas, yeah. Trevor, I think we ended there.
That's right. It just ends.
Exactly. So, we've
got to the end of the movie, Christian.
Oh, my God. All over the place, but our segues were good, and we managed to still end up in the right end.
Well, let's face it, the movie was all over the place.
Yeah, exactly.
What choice did we have?
It wasn't just me who thought so.
Yeah. Well, I guess that that comes to us trying to work out the redeemability of this movie. So I did pick Times Square. So Christian, please let us know your thoughts.
As I grab my notes, how disorganized am I? But Times Square, look, going in, I think going in sort of from the Rocky Horror angle, or as a Tim Curry fan, you know, that was, you know, a big thing, and probably the appeal for a lot of people. The obvious removed scenes just became so obvious, and I think if I hadn't known about it, I would have just thought, this is quite strange, it seems to be missing a lot. There were so many opportunities, like this would have been a great think of the 1980 film Fame, it could have been another version of that where, you know, the songs were almost musical numbers, but not to the point of where it was breakout and song every time. But unfortunately, this comes across more like a serious experience is thrown together and feels a bit like a travelogue of 1979 New York. Let's throw in every cliche and possible thing we can find and see that it sticks. Again, it's so hard to talk about this movie because of those deleted scenes. I can't help but, you know, feel that they have a lot... lot to owe us. It's a great historic record of Times Square in the late 70s, definitely. And I did find that it's a movie held together by the soundtrack. They've come up with this great idea for a soundtrack and worked out what movie can we do. Almost like we experienced with At Last Love, you know. The songs take the place of any other sort of dialogue. And unfortunately, the tastes of music early on were a bit too quick, but by the second half, they made it work. So many things they could have done with this film about the voice of late 70s youth and doing up Times Square and sort of fitting in with the punk mentality. But, yeah, too many ideas were just sort of left on the cutting room floor, I think. So, oh, it's such a tricky one because I want to like it. And there were so many good moments. Well, not so many, but there were a few good moments where I knew this could have worked. But it's on the cusp. But, Trevor, I'm going to have to say it's irredeemable.
Fair enough. Okay, so let's see what I can do with this. Well, I don't know if I can really cover my thoughts too much in the lead up because this movie left me with the question, what? As in, what was it meant to be about? What was it meant to convey? And indeed, what was the point? It jumped around so much, I felt it was basically just a collection of scenes that happened to have the same people in them. Like Tim Curry, it was pretty much irrelevant. He was just there to shove a little bit of exposition in amongst his ramblings. I mean, it was a pretty solid soundtrack. And as you mentioned, the use of the music got better towards the end. But really, I mean, the music was only used cinematically a few times in the entire movie, with the rest being relegated to music that just happened to be playing in the background at the time. I'm certainly going to be sticking to listening to the movie soundtrack for this one. And you know what? This does have a good movie in it. You can kind of see that. And to me, that's what makes it even worse. To have something that, you know, could have been a solid drama with good music about girls running away and forming a punk band in the start of the 1980s, who wouldn't want to see that? Pity they couldn't pull that off because this version of it is not redeemable.
Oh, wow. It was one of those things as you were talking, Trevor, I'm like, oh, maybe he's going to redeem it and I'm going to wish I hadn't, but hadn't. But I think, yeah, one of those cases where the soundtrack's possibly better than the movie. Or in this case, is better than the movie. And, you know, how sometimes you go, yeah, this might be a reason why we haven't heard about this movie. I wonder why. Maybe we've discovered.
Quite possibly. Well, we may not have redeemed Times Square from 1980, but you know what? It has its fans. In fact, I noted that 51% of the reviews on Amazon were 5-star reviews.
Well, I was surprised it was at 6-point-something on IMDb. Very surprised.
Yeah. So I think we do like to finish on a redeemable note. So if we can't redeem it, I've got to find somebody else. So I went back and grabbed another review. The title of this review is A Quarter of a Century Later. I first saw this movie when it was released theatrically back in 1980, and I loved it. Of course, I was just a teenage kid myself then, and just getting into the punk scene. I went back to the theatre and saw it 2 more times before it disappeared. I haven't seen the movie at all in the past 24 years, but it left such an impression on me that I've been looking for it to come out on DVD. At the very least, the movie is a historical document of what a filmmaker in 1980 thought the late 70s punk scene was about, even if he did have to tame down the sexual content that would have made this movie more authentic. 5 stars.
Well, well, well. They exist, by the sounds of it. Hence getting it up to the 6-point-something on IMDb.
Absolutely. So, well... there we go, Times Square, not redeemable. Guess we better move on to what we're watching next, Christian.
Well, well, well. It's so funny because after I finished watching, I'm like, sitting back. Then I'm like, hang on, it's my turn. I shouldn't be getting so comfy. Look, I had a couple of ideas up my sleeve. Like, I have a list I work off, but I decided to go something a little bit different this time and get away from the musicals, I think. It seems like. But actually, it's about like doing something a bit older than what we've been doing. I know we've been doing some 70s and 80s stuff, but even older. Let's call it retro. Boy. Now, my favourite actress of all time is Audrey Hepburn. It's very unusual for her name to come up in a, I suppose, a bad movie list. She didn't release too many films and, you know, I suppose most of the films that were sort of fed or given from Paramount Pictures are quite iconic roles. Now, this movie is often shoved in Paramount Pictures box sets of Audrey Hepburn, almost as I think they've forgotten that this was actually a very big dud. This wedged in between Charade in 1963 with Cary Grant, which was a critical success, and her part in My Fair Lady in 1964, came this film with her past boyfriend William Holden, which was critically panned and, as I said, still keeps being lumped in this collection as I think they're trying to make us think it was a classic, but it never was. So, look, the few times I've watched this, I have enjoyed it. However, I've never watched it with my redeeming features hat on. So we're going to go back to 1964 and look at a French film, not a French film in terms of language, but a film set in France called Paris When It Sizzles.
Rodia, that does ring a bell, but I certainly have never seen Paris When It Sizzles from 1964. Wow, this is really turning into a bit of a discovery time lately.
Definitely.
With our choices.
Definitely, a bit of chance to bring out some other stuff. So, yeah, so interested to see. And hopefully, as I said, it's been released quite a lot by Paramount, so I think it could be quite easy to find a copy of this. But, yeah, I'm definitely interested to hear your thoughts.
Absolutely. So, yeah, well, look, if anyone does want to watch it, I've had a quick check. It is available to rent or buy on Google Play, YouTube, or Apple iTunes. Do they still call that iTunes? I don't know anymore. Apple.
We'll go with it.
So if you do want to check out Paris When It Sizzles before we discuss it in a couple of weeks' time, that is an option there. So at least I also know that I won't have much hassle finding it either. That's always good to know.
Definitely. And let's hope we can get a redeemable film because after Times Square, but we shall see.
Absolutely. And, of course, we would love to hear from you. If you check out Paris When It Sizzles or if you know the movie well or if you have comments about Times Square, let us know. We're super-duper easy to get in touch with. You can find us at rufusproject.com on the web and leave a comment below this very episode. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, or you can send us an email to podcast@rufusproject.com or leave a comment on YouTube. All the stuff's available to you. Have at it.
And we always welcome suggestions because, as we've seen, Trevor, we're probably barely even scraping the surface after all these seasons.
Yeah. And if you want to see the depths we've plumbed and you do head to our homepage, there is a link off to the side there to a list of all the movies we have checked out for this podcast. Oh, there are some doozies in there.
Oh, there's some scary things every time. It's a lot of things that I've put into the deep recesses of my brain that come back up again. But it's an interesting list.
It certainly is. There are actually good movies in there too.
Yes, just have to find them. Yes, we won't tell you which one. You have to listen.
That's right. Absolutely. Now, moving on from our questionable movie choices for this podcast, we can probably talk about perhaps some cult movie options that are coming up soon if you follow Christian Fletcher Events.
Definitely. How sneaky is this, putting up my list very quickly, because I have so many that I can't keep track of them. So in terms of movie nights, we've got so many cult classics coming up, especially for Halloween. We've got Cabinet of Dr. Caligari with a live pianist, and Lost Boys, The Hunger with David Bowie, and Poltergeist from 1982. Also got Goodfellas. Bowie's Down Brunswick returns in November, which is includes a charity walk raising money for Cancer Council, dressing as David Bowie, complete with a David Bowie party, which seems to be the obvious choice. And other movies coming up such as Tank Girl, Showgirls, Reservoir Dogs, Dirty Dancing, and Princess Bride. Way too many to mention here, so head to christianfletcher.com or Christian Fletcher Events on Facebook.
Absolutely. There's a few there that I would like to get to. I hope I can. I will definitely try. I do promise. And good. If you want to check out some other podcasty fun, we also have on the Rufus Project Network, two podcasts and a YouTube channel. It's a network. I don't care what anybody else says.
It is.
So you can also check out the sister podcast, What the History, where myself and my wife Susie sit down and we pull a couple of bizarre bits of history together to entertain and educate you with on a fortnightly basis. There is a bit of a break happening at the moment. Susie, I suppose, is almost doing some first-hand research. She's actually gone overseas at the moment. But when she comes back, we're going to be preparing the second birthday episode of that podcast. So we're pretty excited about that. So in the lead up to that, definitely check out our backlog at wthpod.rufusproject.com. And you can also find all our podcasts on YouTube. And I know I keep promising that I will be getting other stuff up on the YouTube channel in the near future.
Oh, but there's plenty to keep honestly, you going in the meantime.
Absolutely, there is so much there.
Definitely. So from bad movies to good history tidbits. So there's definitely, I think we've got you covered.
Yeah, look, if you can't find something you like in amongst all the stuff we do, then you're not looking hard enough.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, if you like bad movies, bad musicals, well, and things like that. But, yes, definitely a lot to check out there. So, and as we say, Trevor, even if the movies aren't any good, the chats are always a lot of fun.
I love these chats so much. And so I am very much looking forward to chatting Paris when it sizzles in a couple of weeks' time.
Definitely. We're bringing out the rare and obscure ones too.
Indeed we are. So I think on that note, I probably should wrap things up. So thank you so much for listening to the Rufus Project. We may not have been able to redeem Times Square, but as always, the journey is great getting there. And we will catch you next time. Farewell.
Paris when it sizzles? What kind of a picture is it? Well, just for openers, it's a tender, tender love story with monsters, spies, international jewel thieves, school moms, daredevils, cops and robbers, school moms, sex pots, beatniks, a girl who stole the Eiffel Tower, and William Holden and Audrey Hepburn, who go absolutely ape in Paris when it sizzles.
What exactly do you have to do to extract this plan?
Anything.
Anything?
Anything. It's not so hard. I, too, in my own way, of course, am a highly paid professional. Now I know why you keep nibbling on my neck. You're some kind of a werewolf.
No, no, my dear. I'm a vampire.
Well, I'm not that kind of a girl. Oh, I can't stand girls who say things like that. Hardy. Stranger.
You must be the new school mom.
William Holden and Audrey Hepburn go absolutely ape in Paris when it sizzles. And you'll go absolutely ape too when you join them in Paris when it sizzles.
So bad it's good, what's this movie? Do you think we should? Got bad, I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Creatures Gretchen and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. I'm BB, says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Reading teachers.
Boy? Oh boy.
I'm a damn dog!